Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Destiny. Now here's your host, Cliff Dunning.
Hey, how you doing? Welcome to Destiny. And hey, this is the, I guess you could call it the 4th of July weekend. For those of you living in the United States, we celebrate our, what is it, independence? Is this the independence? Yeah, this is when we signed the Declaration of Independence. And so we have a party. Americans have a party. So I hope you're doing well today. Hey, I have a great love for coffee. I love a good cup of coffee in the morning. But I'll tell you, as I've gotten older, I don't like the shakes. I don't like what the caffeine in coffee does to me. So I've been drinking decaf. And I'll tell you, for a long time, and I started this about a year ago. Well, less than a year ago. When I was in Mexico, Mexicans drink really strong coffee. And if you're sensitive to caffeine, boy, you could have a shaky day, a jittery day until it wears off, till your next meal. So I started drinking decaf, and I didn't know that they use chemicals. The chemicals that they place in decaf coffee are the same chemicals they use to process clothing and dry cleaning, and it's really pretty toxic material. And so I've been looking for other solutions. And here in Northern California, it wasn't just necessarily here in Northern California. They found a way to process the caffeination or the caffeine aspects of coffee, of the coffee bean, out through a water process, and costs a little bit more money, but I'll tell you, I am in love with a hot cup of coffee in the morning, decaffeinated. And so I look for these organic water processed beans, and I got to tell you, they figured it out. They really did, because it tastes just like a regular cup. It doesn't smell the same. It smells different. But boy, does it taste good with breakfast. So that's my latest health regime for an aging body. I guess you can call it that. Because I've just gotten really sensitive to caffeine. So I don't drink any Cokes or anything like that. So, but I love my coffee. Got to have my coffee in the morning. Hey, this week we have a fascinating author. His name's John Michael Greer. And John has written numerous books on astrology, but not just astrology, the influences of planets. And today we're talking about a fascinating new book that he's written called The Twilight of Plato, Astrology and the Rise and Fall of Planetary Influence. Now, if you're following Earth Ancients and Destiny, you know that we travel to Egypt and to Mexico every year. I've known for decades that the Maya were very, very much focused on the astrological influences of planets, but even more so, the Egyptians, the ancient dynastic Egyptians, based much of their society on the influences of planets. Now, we don't know a great deal of how they incorporated the influence of these planets, but what we do know is that in their reliefs, in their temples, they have great evidence of working with these planetary influences for daily life, major political trends and influences, decisions on society's norms, agriculture. And we're also noting, and this happens with the Maya, that it's likely that they based the birth charts very, very early. And in some of the temples I've visited, it looks like they were places for birth. That, in other words, the influences, I mean, they could tell what the child was going to grow up to be. They could tell a lot of different things. So important was the influence as of the planets on human physiology that at the Hathor Temple in Dendera, on the top floor next to the observatory, is a huge relief of all the astrological signs and very unusual hieroglyphs. Now, in the 1700s, Napoleon's scientific team actually removed the entire roof of this temple and took it to Paris. And you can see it in the Louvre, which is their major museum, up close and personal. I mean, I don't know why they haven't returned that yet, but anyhow, there's a reproduction of it in Egypt, and it's very detailed. It's very ornate, and a lot of the writing has not been deciphered, so we don't know what they're telling us, but the observation deck at this temple, Hathor Temple in Dendera, is fascinating to see, and there's a number of specific designs in this observatory where you stand and you can look up, because they didn't have telescopes then, you can look up and see the five planets: Mars, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, Mercury, and of course our sun and our moon. These are the closest things to us, or the we're able to see these things in details. What we don't know, and what we're going to hear from today, is that there's no way to measure the energy of these planets on the human body and on Earth. Perhaps in the ancient pre-dynastic times, they had a way to measure the energy. But what is fascinating about astrology is that the human body is the tuning fork, is the receiver of the energy, and this is how we know that these influences of planets work. Now, when you get an astrological chart done, when you go to an astrologer, they don't just guess at it. They use specific mathematical software programs to calculate the date you were born, the planetary influences, and from that, they can set a chart out for a few months, a year, up to many years of what you can expect from these planetary influences. Now, a lot of people say, well, this is hogwash. It doesn't make sense. How can planets influence us? Well, look, the ancients, Maya, the Chinese, the Egyptians, these guys spent extreme amounts of energy calculating the influence of these planets to base their societies, to grow their food, their crops, to live a very harmonious and holistic lifestyle. And remember, these societies live for thousands and thousands of years. And so there's something to it. So when modern day scientists say, oh, this is all BS, doesn't work for me, here we go again. The scientific method just cannot conceive of a way to measure a lot of this influence. They can't figure it out. And so because they can't figure it out, they consider it occultism. they consider it not valid whatsoever. Well, as depressing as that sounds, millions upon millions of people get their charts done, look at the horoscope each day to see what can be expected from the week, the month, the year for their chart. Now, I suggest if you really want to know your specific chart and the planetary influences on you, go to an accredited astrologer, and you can either do the Hindu specific types, or you can do the sidereal, which is the common type of astrological chart that you can get, that you read in the paper. So check that out if you're really interested, and you'll be surprised. I had a Hindu chart done a few years ago, and I was blown away by how accurate it was. Guy didn't know who I was, didn't know anything about me, but from the date I was born, from the time I was born, and strangely, from the location I was born, he was able to put together a very, very accurate chart of who I was energetically and what the future foretold for me as a human being living on planet Earth. So that's something to consider. All right, our program today is with John Michael Greer. Just a real pleasure to interview. We're going to have John back later in the fall. The book we're talking about today has just come out, The Twilight of Pluto, Astrology and the Rise and Fall of Planetary Influence.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Course of many months, we've had astrologers on the program, including some very well noted people like Susan Miller, the Astrology Zone. I'm going to call her the priestess of that because she is very much dialed in on what's going on with astrology. But we haven't talked about the influences of planets before, during, and after their discovery. And today I have a wonderful guest talking about a new book that he's written on not only the influences of planetary systems, but the reason I really like this book is it kind of gives us a history of how the ancients noted planets and their influences and how they were interpreted, which is fascinating to me. As you all know, I've been to Egypt a couple of times. I've been to the various temples, and the ancients really venerated astrology much more than we do today. Why we don't support astrology like the ancients and make it a science is really a question for our guest today, who is John Michael Greer. He's written a book called The Twilight of Pluto, Astrology and the Rise and Fall of Planetary Influences. What a great title. Hey, John, welcome to Destiny. Great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me on.
I guess the first question I have for you is, obviously you're somebody who's been studying astrology, its varied influences on Earth humans. Why a book on this topic? What inspired you to write a book on the influences?
Well, there are a couple of possible answers to that question. The easy one is that I'm a writer by trade, and so normally when I find something that really interests me, the sort of reflex, the knee-jerk response is, ooh, I could write a book about that. But more specifically, when I actually came to the study of astrology a little later than some, certainly. My interests in Western esoteric traditions generally date back to my teen years. But when I was a teenager, I looked into astrology and said, whoa, this is amazingly complex and complicated and dry, and I think I'm going to leave it until I'm middle age. Fast forward until about 15 years ago, and I looked at myself in the mirror, the gray hairs showing up, and this kind of says, okay, time for astrology. I'm middle aged now. So I started to study. I got some good books. I got some not so good books. I got some really lousy books. I read them all. I started working with my horoscope and doing all the usual stuff. And one of the things I noticed at that time is that a lot of the astrology texts that were available were talking about Pluto a lot. And they were saying, you know, when you have something transiting your natal Pluto, your life will roll over and drop dead, or something fairly close to that. They had just all of these horrible predictions about this, your life will be turned upside down and everything will blow up in your face, and ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. Now, at that time, as I was beginning to keep track of my transits and so on, I noticed, oh, Lord, I have two major Pluto transits, planets transiting my natal Pluto, coming up starting next year. Oh, Lord, isn't that going to be fun? So I was braced. I was ready for it. And nothing happened. Seriously, nothing happened. I've been tracking my Saturn activities. Both of my Saturn returns now have been a little bit of a rough road. Other transits were coming in very clearly, very loud and strong. But then there was Pluto. And, of course, this was right around the time that the International Astronomical Union downgraded Pluto from the status of planet to that of dwarf planet.
Right. Yeah.
And so I was going, maybe somebody needs to look into this. And since I didn't see anyone else putting up their pink little hand, I decided to research the subject. So I started studying Pluto, its discovery, its astrological influences. I started paying attention to the fact that there had been a couple of other planets that were discovered, quote-unquote, and then people realized that they weren't actually planets and they were downgraded the way Pluto was. I paid a lot of attention to the discovery of other planets. What happened when Uranus was discovered? What happened when Neptune was discovered and so on? And gradually that came together, and if you're used to astrology, you know how you put all these data points together and everything fits on the chart, and then gradually meaning coalesces out of it. Well, that's basically what happened. And so a couple of years ago, I said, okay, time to write. And the book took shape promptly.
Yeah, amazing. I have to mention to our listeners that you are an archdruid, which is fascinating as a title. That must play into your work as an astrologer.
No. I am an Archdruid Emeritus at this point. I served for 12 years as the Grand Archdruid of the Ancient Order of Druids in America, larger Druid orders in this country. But I actually wound up that part of my career in 2015.
Okay.
I decided at that point, I had been in the hot seat for 12 years. I had had most of the rest of my life on hold because it was a fairly busy job. And there were other people who had come up through the ranks and were ready to take on the challenge and the hard work of running a Druid order. So I stepped down and handed it over. You know, there was plenty of advance notice in this kind of stuff, but I loaded it off on some, I passed the buck to someone else.
But because
and
you
got to work doing other things.
But you stepped down, but you're still a druid, aren't you?
Oh, of course I'm still a druid.
Yeah.
I don't currently run a druid order.
Okay. The reason I find it interesting is that you do mention Stonehenge in your book.
Oh, yeah.
And that is a fascinating structure. Uh-huh. I haven't been there yet.
Oh, yeah.
But
make time to go there and do it when the tourists aren't there.
I'm hoping to go in November around Thanksgiving.
Oh,
I don't know if that's
nice.
Good.
And if you have the chance, if you get over there, go 20 miles north to Avebury.
Avebury.
It's in Avebury. That's another big stone circle.
Okay.
And it's worth your while. Both of those are amazing places.
Okay, I'll put Avebury on my list.
Avebury, yeah. Put them on the list. It's easy to get from one to the other.
You're the perfect person to talk about subtle energy. I am a Reiki teacher. I haven't been teaching in years. But when we address astrology, when we address how the ancients looked at astrology, it was more of a science for them. I think they, would you say that they, and you mentioned the Sumerians in your book, they took astronomy and astrology and kind of made it one, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is they didn't draw a distinction between them. Nobody did until really about, I think it was like the 17th century when Europeans started drawing that distinction, because you had your rationalists coming up. You had your scientific materialists who were saying, you know, dead matter is the only thing that's real. And therefore, we're going to ignore everything that has to do with subtle energies. We're going to ignore everything that has to do with consciousness. And we're going to ghettoize astrology from it. We're going to raise a Berlin Wall between astronomy and astrology.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seems like a really dumb idea to me, but apparently it made sense at the time. I'm sure we can all say that, thinking back on dumb things we've done. That made sense at the time. Well, you know, hopefully our culture will outgrow it. Go ahead.
Right. But the thing that's fascinating about your book is that you actually describe the influence on Earth humans of these pre-post discoveries of planets. And I just want you to talk a little bit about the disconnect that we have today and how I think it's a serious mistake. Although millions of people look at daily horoscopes, monthly horoscopes, and these are not direct to their birth date, which means they're not very accurate. They're still grasping enough of the data and feel that the information is significant enough to follow it.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to the academic world? Why are they not following this?
Well, okay, this is a complicated matter here. The academic world is stuck. You've probably seen this. Any subculture, any group that sets itself apart from society always defines itself by what it excludes. You know, the country club says, well, we don't want any of those poor people. You know, this political party doesn't want anyone from that political party, or what have you. Every group defines itself by what it won't let in. And so the academic community is just another subculture. And back in the 17th century, when modern materialist science was defining itself, was setting itself up as a subculture and making these grandiose claims about how it was going to bring utopia, one of the things they excluded at that time was anything having to do with subtle energies, anything having to do with occultism or magic or astrology. That was bad. We don't let that into our clubhouse. And that was part of that. There were complicated reasons rooted in cultural politics why that happened, and it's really it resulted in a certain amount of real embarrassment, because a lot of the important early scientists were also occultists. I mean, Isaac Newton was a practicing alchemist, and a good one too. Robert Boyle, who practically founded chemistry, he was another alchemist. There were a lot of these people who were into occult teachings, but that became kind of a skeleton in the closet as this academic subculture emerged. And we're still saddled with that same thing in the academic scene. They don't want to have anything to do with that nasty, icky occultism up there. It's, you know, it's like the treehouse with the sign that says no girls allowed. they've got their treehouse that says no astrologers allowed on it, and that's all it is.
But now, go ahead.
The great thing, the good news here, compare sometime the number of people who make their living as astronomers with the number who make their living as astrologers. Compare the number of books published on astronomy to the number of books published on on astrology.
Yeah.
And so the astrologers are winning the race.
Yeah.
At this point, observatories are scrambling to try to stay funded. I keep on telling people I know in the sciences, no, what you need to do is simply bring in some astrologers, start offering horoscopes. You'll pay all your bills. Mm. They're horrified. They have cattle.
How dare you talk about this?
How dare you? And yet, Johannes Kepler, the guy who discovered the planets orbit in ellipses, he paid for his astronomical work by casting horoscopes. He was an astrologer.
Wow.
He was a good one. And so they need to get back to their roots. They need to.
Well, that's my question, John. Is it because of the unseen planetary influences that immediately? I mean, we can't measure it. I mean, the scientific method has no basis. They can't work a way to discover unseen energy. So maybe that's what throws it out the window for them.
Oh, man. Now, the thing is, there are a lot of things that you can only detect through their effects. Scientists use a huge amount of statistical analysis, of proxy measures, all these things, when we can't actually detect something. Neutrinos. There's essentially no way to directly detect a neutrino. And so they use all of these complicated roundabout methods to catch the influences of neutrinos as they go zipping through matter. It's exactly the same thing with astrology. I promise you, if I had the kind of budget that goes into detecting neutrinos, I could probably set up a series of research projects that would end up being able to detect planetary influences. But try getting the grants.
Yeah. So you think it would be possible to actually prove the... how these different planets that we are aware of influence Earthlings?
Yes.
Wow.
I think it would be possible given adequate funding and adequate researchers and an unbiased approach to the question. I think it would in fact be possible to demonstrate very clearly that these things actually work. I mean, anybody who's actually done astrology for any length of time knows just how effective this stuff is. We've all watched things go haywire during Mercury retrogrades.
Yeah.
We all know, oh boy, the moon's just gone void, of course. You can feel it. I don't think it would be hard at all, again, given an adequate research budget and so on, to actually prove this stuff. I think the ancients did that. They had simpler methods. I mean, their mathematical tools were not as sophisticated as ours, but they understood how to use sensitized human minds and sensitized human psyches to tune into the universe, to sense what was happening. And that was a secret that they had and we've mostly lost.
Yeah. Speaking of the ancients, you make a great statement in the book. You say that the discovery of the precession of the equinoxes, which the Sumerians wrote about, was handed down to them by an unknown civilization or earlier people.
Oh, yeah.
Would you say that when you say that, my thinking is this the mother culture of Atlantis? Is this a very, very early culture that has been lost to time?
We don't know. We simply don't know. What we know is that many of the important astrological or astronomical terms in Sumerian, including the names of the planets, are not Sumerian words. They come from a different language. And so right there, you know that you've got the traces, and it's not even a language related to Sumerian. And so you look at that and you go, oh, really? There's something else going on here. Now, there is, in fact, some reason to think that there were civilizations going back quite possibly a very long time before the ones that we know about, the ones that we happen to have records for. There is the little fact that sea level worldwide rose, 300 feet after the last ice age. So most of what would have been the settled agricultural urban areas are underwater now.
Mm. That's a really good point.
People talk about Atlantis. If you take the date that Plato gives in his dialogue, where he actually describes Atlantis, he's the oldest source we've got, and he gives a date for when Atlantis went under, and that date is the same date as the end of the Younger Dryas cold spell, the point at which global warming kicked in very powerfully at the end of the last ice age, and sea levels shot up. So, yes, lands being suddenly flooded. Gosh, where have we heard that before?
Hmm. Fascinating.
In fact, there's every reason to think that what we have in the Atlantis legend is a dim memory of actual events at the end of the last ice age. But go on.
Yeah, but I'm just curious. You made a study of some of these ancient cultures, and you mentioned Babylonians and Sumerians. Mm-hmm. A lot of these guys appear on the scene complete. In other words, they have a society that's complete. And it's almost like it's handed down to them, some kind of a blueprint. Do you feel that's a possibility?
Oh, possibly that, or possibly they simply moved there from somewhere else. Keep in mind, again, we have sea levels rising. Okay, the sea is rising at a foot a year. Your water sources are now tainted with salt water. You can't grow your crops. What are you going to do? You're going to move somewhere high up.
Hmm.
And so you show up. You appear on the scene. And if we had archaeologists digging through the bottom of the Persian Gulf, they might find all kinds of stuff. But that's kind of awkward.
Yeah.
So could it have been handed down by someone? Possibly. Could it have been refugees from some drowned civilization who showed up and the locals were going, wow, you could do some really neat stuff. Can you show us how to do that? And there you have a civilization.
Exactly.
Or what have you. Yeah. We simply don't know. But it's very clear... the discovery not that many decades ago of the ruins at Göbekli Tepe, which are, of course, all over the news these days, which turn out to be monumental architecture dating back, 12,000 years? And you have the city of Jericho, which had a stone tower, it had a stone wall and a stone tower around it. The archaeologist who dug it up said, this would not be out of place in a castle in the European Middle Ages. It's that sophisticated. That kind of architectural skill does not just show up out of nowhere. There were obviously other buildings being built using the same techniques long before then. Where? We don't know. So, yeah, there's a lot we don't know. And the canned certainties of the sort of corporate media, of the official version of the past, I hope we can outgrow that sometime soon.
Well, I... have been to a number of these ancient places where they're 3,000 to 5,000 years old and unknown if they're older. And I did mention Egypt before. There's a temple in Dendera, the Hathor Temple, and on the ceiling is the astrological cluster of different influences, the different characters, all laid out beautifully. The French took it and moved it to Paris, but there's still a copy
because
of it there.
Because, of course,
there.
They did. Yeah.
This is a big sign to me, and I'm just curious. This was extremely important to the ancients. In fact, would you say it was like a lifeline in many ways?
Well, I think that would be one way to talk about it, certainly. I tend to think of it, in our science, physics is the most important science. Physics is the science to which everything goes back. For the ancients, it was astrology. Wow. That was the core science. That was the knowledge from which everything else derived. If I may mention a book to your readers that I'm sure you're familiar with, Hamlet's Mill.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
By Georges de Santayana and Hertha van Dehend. The way that they show that these same precessional myths can be found in the old world, in the new world, all over the planet, down to fine details, clearly a very, very, very long time ago. People were paying exquisitely close attention to the stars and to the movement of the stars and planets, and they used, they used the suitable technologies they had. In this case, storytelling, mythology is an information storage technology, and that's what they used to pass on crucial pieces of information. So we know it was of central importance to them. We know that astrology was the core of their way of understanding the universe. And that was true in the Western world as late as 1500. You read stuff from the Renaissance. You read Cornelius Agrippa, and it's very clear. You start with a knowledge of astrology, and everything unfolds from it.
Amazing. One of the real strengths and pleasures of your book is how new discoveries of planets influence culture and even technology. You mentioned that before Pluto was discovered, and Pluto was discovered in 1930, Earthlings were feeling its presence. What were the influences that came about before, and then when it was discovered, what was the primary societal changes?
Yeah. I want to start by just to give our listeners some background. What I found is, first of all, it's not that the discovery of the planet causes these things to happen. It's the other way around. Planets are discovered when it's time for them to be discovered. Mm. Planets are downgraded when it's time for them to be downgraded. Astronomers are as strongly influenced by astrological factors as everyone else. So that's a misunderstanding a lot of people have. I'm not saying that the International Astronomical Union downgraded Pluto and therefore its influence shifted. Its influence was failing. It was time for it to be downgraded, and so they, puppets of the stars, did what they were supposed to. So, what I found in my research of these planets of Uranus, Neptune, Vulcan, the so-called dark moon Lilith, the first planet, then asteroid, now dwarf planet Ceres, and Pluto, is that there's about a 30-year window, about a one Saturn cycle, before a planet is discovered, when its influence starts to ramp up. Mm. And there's a 30-year period after the planet is downgraded or its existence is disproven, as in the case of Vulcan. It takes about 30 years for it to trickle off to zero. So keep that in mind as we go, because here we have Pluto was discovered in 1930. 1900, what happens? What happens if you have Sigmund Freud coming on and saying the individual, the psyche, the mind is not a unity. We can split it in half into the conscious and unconscious minds. And if we do this, we release psychological energy. That's the basic principle of Freudian psychology. Okay. At the same time, you have Albert Einstein going, the atom is not a unity. It is not unbreakable. We can split the atom in half and release enormous amounts of energy, equals MC squared. Now, the thing about this, the word individual and the word atom, individual in Latin, atom in Greek, mean can't be divided. Individuum, atomos, if you know the language in question. The first expression of the Plutonian energy was splitting things that supposedly couldn't be divided.
Hmm.
And so as Pluto's influence came in, you started having these fissures open up in society, these splits between left and right, between communists and capitalists, between the law and the underworld. Of course, Pluto very heavily, you had the most catastrophic wars in human history, and all of it boiling up. You had the aesthetic, the artistic and musical avant-garde versus everything else. You have all of these schisms, all of these splits and divisions open up. That's Pluto's keynote. It's one of Pluto's keynotes. It's the planet opposed to unity. It's the planet that splits unities apart. And so we watched that happen all the way through, up into the 1930, Pluto was discovered, the world was torn, was in the middle of the Great Depression, it was torn between the haves and have-nots, it was torn between the fascists and the democratic powers, it was torn by World War II, the largest war in human history. The splitting of the atom took place, and Hiroshima and Nagasaki were vaporized. Mm-hmm. And then the world was split down the middle into the communist world and the free world. And we had the Cold War. And so you had all of these Plutonian factors just boiling up with immense force. And that's where it gets interesting, because everyone was assuming it's just going to keep on getting more and more, getting worse and worse, getting more and more divided. If you read fiction written back from then in the 1950s, for example, the idea was that, of course, the Soviet Union would just remain this immense monolithic power, and we'd probably all die in a nuclear war sometime very soon, and technology was unstoppable, and the underworld was unstoppable, and all these plutonian things were unstoppable, except they weren't. Because the other hallmark of Pluto is it's the planet of overblown hype. Every Plutonian phenomenon comes in with a bang and fades out with a whimper. And so Pluto arrived with a bang. When Pluto's discovery was announced, it was front page news. People were talking about it. Walt Disney named Mickey Mouse's dog Pluto the pup.
I remember you writing about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. one of those popular laxatives of the time was called Pluto Water, and its slogan was "When nature won't, Pluto will," which is the Plutonian spirit in a nutshell. But all this time, you know, people, when Pluto was first postulated, when the scientists first said, "We think there's a planet out there," they figured it was the size of Neptune. They figured it was big. And then when they discovered it, the little dot that they found was not big enough for that. So they said, well, maybe it's the size of the Earth. And then, of course, the methods of measuring the size of a distant planet got better, and we finally, you know, we got better telescopes. We finally got some telescopes in orbit. We finally sent a space probe out to orbit Pluto, which, you know, once you can do that, you can figure out exactly how big a planet is. It's tiny. It's like 1/400th the size of Earth. It's like 1/7th the size of Earth's moon. Mm. It's a tiny little snowball, basically. And that was the reason why the astronomers said, this isn't a planet. This is a lump of ice. You know, this is a snowball. And so that was something people were talking about actually quite a long time before 2006, that it's not really a planet. It's too tiny. It's you know, it's not much bigger than an asteroid. And that's so you can see that tendency for things to come boiling up big and then trickle out into just a little bitty snowball circling out in the darkness.
We're going to take a short commercial break, and we will be right back with John Michael Greer.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6-packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're speaking with author John Michael Greer on a new book he has written called The Twilight of Pluto, Astrology and the Rise and Fall of Planetary Influences. This is a look at just how important our neighboring planets are, the ones we know about and the ones we're about to discover, and how they influence human beings on Earth. But would you say that the ancients who were working with these planetary energies had a way to transmute it? So as you were saying, Jupiter or not Jupiter.
I'm thinking Pluto.
Pluto, excuse me, was, you know, has these so-called influences that are kind of like a farce. You even talked about it in the beginning. But perhaps the ancients were so locked in. They had a sense of the energy, but they were able to transmute it in some way. What do you think?
Oh, you can do that. You can do that with planetary energies now.
You can.
There's one of the great maxims of the old astrologers is fools are ruled by their stars. The wise rule their stars. Okay, if you have, let's say Saturn is in a strong position in your chart, whether, let's say, you know, you're getting a Saturn transit, okay? Oh, people will scream and moan and, oh, I have a Saturn transit. No. What is Saturn good for? It's good for patience. It's good for stability. It's good for anything slow and steady and stable. It's great for real estate, by the way. It is great for deep thought. If Saturn is in a good position in your natal chart, you can probably handle like philosophy and other, you know, really modes of deep thinking. So you take that influence and you apply it. You give it a place to go in your life. You say, okay, I'm going to do these slow and patient things. I'm going to spend some time doing some deep thinking. I'm not going to try to make things happen in a hurry because it won't happen when Saturn's moving, you know, Saturn's in this, going through this transit. You can take that energy, use it, transmute it. Another great example of this, Mercury retrogrades. I'm sure half our listeners are used to people who go, oh God, Mercury's about to go retrograde. I'm doomed. No. When Mercury is retrograde, anything that begins with re, it goes really well in Mercury retrograde. You just have to be willing to back up with Mercury. I use it to revise. I use Mercury retrogrades to revise manuscripts, to revisit old projects, to resubmit things to publishers. I do most of my best editing when Mercury is retrograde. So I'll schedule it. I'll know, okay, Mercury's going to be retrograde in another 3 weeks. Okay, great. I can write up to then. And then I'm going to put those 3 weeks of the retrograde or so, I'm going to put those into hardcore editing, getting my manuscripts really polished. And then after Mercury turns around, whoosh, off they go to the publisher, and the publisher goes, wow, this is great. And, you know, you can use all these things. And the ancients knew that. The ancients knew that perfectly well. Too many people these days, you know, they're passive. They're thinking, they think that astrology is you know, this astrological influences are just what they are. But you can work with them. You just have to learn how.
That's a whole thought process there that we could actually, if we were more tuned in, we could actually tailor our lives a little better to these powerful influences.
Funny you should mention that. My next book on astrology, which is mostly done right now, is on that subject.
Wow.
Amazing. I will make sure you get a copy from the publisher.
Well, we'll definitely have you back on, John, for that.
I will. I'll look forward to talking about it. But yeah. Yeah, so this is the way that that astrology was done. This is the way it was played back in the day. You know, you would look at what was happening in your natal chart. You look at what was happening in your transits, in your annual progression, and things like that, and go, cool, okay, this and this are going to be easy, this and this are going to be hard. And then there's this wild card, you know, Mercury's doing what? Okay.
Yeah.
And you deal. Yeah. And you put it to good use. So yeah.
Yeah, amazing. You say something fascinating in your book. You say the discovery of a new planet corresponds with the awakening of the collective consciousness of our species.
Oh, yeah.
That's a profound statement. Can you give us an example?
Sure. The easiest ones are Uranus and Neptune, because, of course, those happened fairly recently in history, in 1782 and 1846. And watch what, if you read history from the period at all, and keep in mind that 30-year lead-in period in each case, At each point, you have the emergence of ways of thinking about the world that basically you didn't have before. Uranus, it's the planet of eccentricity. It's the planet of individuality. It's the planet of science fiction. It's the planet of technology. So Uranus shows up, and what do we have? We have the emergence of modern democratic governments. We have the idea of the rights of the individual, which was not an idea anybody had. But Uranus came through when it was time for that to be brought up. And all of a sudden people are going, whoa, me as an individual person should have rights, irrespective of any other factor. You have the development of the first subcultures, the first countercultures. You have the emergence of sexual minorities. You have gay and lesbian cultures emerging for the first time as separate cultures rather than just, you know, individual people doing things that, you know, having slightly unusual sexual habits. You actually have subcultures emerging. You have the Industrial Revolution. You have the birth of science fiction. A teenage girl sitting in a in a hotel room in Switzerland, being, you know, the vacation has been rained out, and she and her friends decide they're going to write spooky stories. Her name's Mary Shelley. She comes up with a story called Frankenstein, and science fiction is born. And we can just go on for a long time, but the point is that when Uranus showed up, there's all of this truckload of influences that it brought with it that are still rattling through society and are still shaping our lives and our thinking right now. Okay, fast forward to 1846. Neptune is the planet of unities. It's the planet of dreams and visions. It's the planet of delusion and illusion. It's the planet of intoxication. So what do we have when Neptune takes role? First of all, we have the emergence of the idea that society has a responsibility to care for its weaker members. The idea of welfare, the idea of like Social Security and other of old age pensions. Those didn't exist. Nobody thought of that as a valid idea. But the idea that maybe society should take care of people who need it, that came with Neptune. That's an aspect of unity. At the same time, drugs. It was, I mean, alcohol goes way back, but and some other things were used in a sacred setting. But Neptune shows up, and all of a sudden it's, whee, opium, whee, you know, chloroform. people were getting ripped on chloroform.
Yeah.
And on we go. You have the invention of fantasy fiction as distinct from science fiction. That's the Neptunian literature. You have this whole cascade of factors coming into society again with Neptune. We were ready for it. We were ready to expand our consciousness to include these very challenging modes of being. Because, you know, from the point of view of somebody sitting in, say, 1750, when the Uranian influence hadn't hit yet and the Neptunian was so far away, a lot of this stuff that we're talking about, a lot of the Uranian-Neptunian forces would have been just incomprehensible, just totally bizarre. And yet, we're still processing them. We're still working through, you know, what are the rights of the individual? How do they relate to the duty of the society to take care of the weak and vulnerable? Mm. How do we balance these things against each other? How do we make sense? You know, where's the line between science fiction and fantasy on a very simple level? What do we do about drugs? What do we do about, you know, about countercultures and deviant, you know, deviant subcultures and so on? It will be probably thousands of years before that's finally settled. We know this because we've got a pretty good idea when the five classical planets were discovered, and it took a couple of thousand years for them to sort that out too.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Okay, here's one for you that I got a hint in the book, but I don't think you really designed it. What happens when we start looking at exoplanets? These are planets that are very Earth-like, and we're finding them, and we're identifying them, but are they influencing us?
We don't know that yet. Here's the thing about astrology. Astrology is an empirical science. We find out what influences are out there by tracking things in horoscopes and seeing what happens. I mean, when Pluto was discovered, people didn't just, you know, reach into their backsides and pull out, oh, this is what Pluto means. They started, astrologers all around the world started casting charts, figuring out where Pluto was at people's birth, where Pluto is now, and started saying, oh, wow, look at what Pluto seems to be doing. Okay, this is what Pluto does in this sign. This is what Pluto does in aspect of that planet. That's how we know about Pluto. So these exoplanets, astrologers are going to have to track those points in the heavens.
So that's a mathematical process is what you're saying.
Yeah, mathematical, but also interpretive. Okay, here's this exoplanet orbiting, I don't know, Tau Ceti, let's say. Okay, well, we know where Tau Ceti is. We know where it is in the zodiac. Okay, does that point seem to do anything? When a planet is at that point, are its effects different? How does that affect this horoscope? How does that affect that horoscope? How does it affect these transits or these progressions? Decades of work will have to go into that. They're still trying to figure out Eris, the third dwarf planet, the one that's out beyond Pluto. I mean, they know where it is. They're tracking it. It's slow. But astrologers right now are busy, you know, casting charts that have Eris located on it and saying, okay, what is it doing? What does it affect? What are its influences? What are its strengths and weaknesses? How powerful is it? That's how we figure these things out in astrology. It's not a matter of theory. It's a matter of empirical observation.
Hmm. But you gave us a really good idea. 30 years prior to the discovery, the influences are felt. So are you saying that we need to be able to see it closer? How do we define the beginning of the influence, or do we not know that?
We don't really know.
Okay.
All we know, it's really hard to check these things in advance. Okay. What we can do is look at like Pluto or Neptune or Uranus or Ceres or Vulcan or any of these others, and say, okay, well, we know that, let's say, Ceres was discovered in 1801, and we know that when Ceres was discovered, you have the whole movement of Romanticism. You have this whole cultural theme that came in with Ceres. Okay, how far back does that go? As you trace that back, you know, back before 1801, well, it goes back to about 1771. You have the emergence of Romanticism right around then. And so in the same way with Pluto, I'm looking at, okay, when did that opposition to unity show up? Well, it showed up with a bang right around 1900. I don't think it's necessarily exactly 30 years. It probably varies depending on, you know, the movements of Saturn or what have you. Saturn is the lord of time. But it seems to be around 30 years.
That's amazing. It's so funny when we talk about astrology. It, in many ways, the physiology of the human is the tuning fork that is feeling these influences. There's really no technology that we know about other than math that can detect that, right?
What we can do, well, I mean, there's no technology, because no technological device we've been able to come up with is as sensitive to these things as a human being.
Right.
And the thing is that's been true of a lot of things. I mean, you don't usually use a machine to tune a piano. You use a piano tuner, because a trained piano tuner, his sensitivity to the notes is much, much better than any machine that has yet been discovered. He can tune it more exactly. And so there's a lot of things like that. You don't have a chemical analysis do wine tasting. And astrology is the same way. Now, you can, through exercises like meditation, increase your sensitivity so that you can perceive these astrological factors more clearly. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons that I certainly recommend meditation for people who are interested in this stuff. You know, just put a little time of that in every day. You become more sensitive. You begin to perceive things. You reach the point where you go, something just happened. You go to the ephemeris, and guess what? The moon went void, of course.
So you have your little book, your little encyclopedia.
Yeah. You'll flip it open and say, well, what happened? Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah, Venus just entered Taurus. No wonder I'm feeling more romantic.
Okay. Well, that's more than a little bit. You have to have a little bit of background in the astrological fundamentals to be able to determine that.
So. Well, but the thing is, that's in a saner society, everyone would have that anyway.
Well, that's my next question for you, and this is a real challenge. In the democratic experiment known as the United States, what the hell is going on right now? We're politically divided. And, you know, we're supposed to be this beacon of hope for the world. We are in a really tough period. What can you tell us about that?
Okay, well, first of all, the idea that we're supposed to be a beacon of hope for the world, that's all very nice. But no nation on earth can be that all the time.
Yeah.
Okay? There have been certain points in American history where we have done that. But no nation can do that 24/7. Come on. And so it so happens that for a variety of reasons, some of them astrological, if you take the U.S. Foundation chart and run progressions across it and so on, you'll see there are ups and downs. There are crisis periods. We're in one of those crisis periods right now. And we're going to have to sort things out. Since the stars, as the saying goes, the stars incline, they do not compel. They don't force things to happen. They just tilt the table this way and tilt the table that way. We, as a nation, have to decide, are we going to use this this crisis period the way we used the one in the 1930s to pull ourselves together to get rid of some bad habits, to recognize that, you know, the highest goal of American life is not to allow a handful of really rich people to get even richer. And that maybe we, you know, maybe there's some more important goal in life or goal for our nation, and, you know, get our feet under us again.
We did that
in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. We can do it again, but will we? That's not something the stars can tell us. That's something that individual Americans have to decide. Are we going to look at ourselves, say, look at the things that didn't work and admit, okay, well, that was a flop, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And go do something else. Or are we going to say, well, I don't care, you know, I'm right. Everyone else is wrong. The stars are wrong. The history is wrong because this is what I want.
Well, it's funny because I see these astrologers looking at the United States as an entity, which many people mm-hmm. believe it is, and other countries mm-hmm. are in the same ballpark. But, you know, what planets are stronger and less is influential? And, I mean, mm-hmm. it's almost like it's a period of schizophrenia, it seems like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, most nations go through this kind of thing. Most nations have been through these periods where they're split down the middle, where they're confused and baffled, where nothing works right anymore. It's a normal thing in the cycle of national history. Mm. And it depends on, you know, whether people put on their you know, big boy or girl pants and rise to the challenge or not.
Hmm. Fascinating. One of the interesting aspects, and I keep an eye on current events, mm-hmm. Elon Musk just announced Tesla's robot Optimus, which is a manual labor bot. And I was just curious
just
to know
what we need.
Yeah, I know. It's, a lot of people are like, what are you talking about? But apparently it's very, very sophisticated. It can lift 150 pounds. Mm-hmm. It is supposed to be taking over menial labor types of jobs that mm-hmm. people don't want.
Just hold it for a moment. That people don't want, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, in point of fact, if you pay people a living wage, they want those jobs.
Yeah.
What Elon Musk is doing is giving his fellow multi-billionaires another way to cut wages and to leave a whole bunch of people to starve. I don't think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Now, the one great thing, the great thing to hope for here is that Elon Musk is a very Plutonian person. Overhype is his middle name. Okay. He's done some cool things, but I don't hold your breath for his Mars thing anytime soon. And his solar panel business crashed and burned. And he's great at promoting. Mm. I want to see if this robot actually turns out to be worth anything, or if it's just a stunt.
Well, he's going to release it in September for the public to see. That's what he just announced yesterday. So
okay, so we will see at that point. Is it the wave of the future, or is it like, do you remember Google Glasses?
Oh, those are a complete bust. Yeah.
Exactly. They were going to be the wave of the future, except everyone looked at them and said, "What? Sorry, I'm not that stupid." You know, so yeah. Just because some rich moron decides that something is the way of the future doesn't mean that people are going to buy into it. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
Okay. I have a thought for you. We've had scientists mm-hmm. on. We had Chandra Rick-Ramsey on here mm-hmm. Who came up with the panspermia mm-hmm. idea. Do you think this a possibility that we are – under the direction, our evolution is being directed by an ancient race that is seeding Earth with the idea. But in the case of the astrological format or theme, developing or getting us to connect with new planetary systems, which raises our consciousness, which raises our society, which raises the human condition?
Well, If you take that out of the language of science fiction, you're talking the basic theory of religion. The basic idea of religion is that there are these beings much more intelligent than human beings who are helping to guide human destiny. We call them gods and goddesses, okay? If you want to call them, you know, alien superintelligences, how huge is the difference there? Are there intelligences that shape and guide human existence? I think so. Are they doing it by physical means, as in the panspermia hypothesis? Or are they doing it by spiritual means? I don't happen to know. I'm open to all possibilities.
Well, I was waiting for you to say, well, yeah, the U.S. Space Command now, you know, changed UFOs to unidentified aerial phenomena. Okay. Maybe that has some. That's a clue.
How far down that rabbit hole do you want to go?
I don't want to go very far because I think there's a lot of cover up. Anyhow,
no kidding, and not necessarily what people like to talk about. I have a book on the subject called the UFO Chronicles, which is talking about the way that U.S. military intelligence manufactured many UFO sightings to cover up testing of U.S. Aerospace technology. When we were testing, well, here's the great example, of course, is the Black Triangles.
Right.
Very late 1970s, early 1980s, all of a sudden people started seeing these mysterious black triangles. They must be alien spacecraft. What were we testing at that time that looked like a black triangle? Stealth. The stealth technology was in its earliest days at that point. And gosh, these black triangles, they must be alien craft. It was camouflage. It was U.S. intelligence camouflage used to try to distract people from an aerospace technology. The U.S. military has been playing the UFO scene for a bunch of fools since 1947, using that. Are there other things going on besides that? Of course there are. There are a whole range of them. Talk about that in that book of mine. But any time you hear the U.S. Space Command or the U.S. Navy or the U.S. Air Force babbling about UFOs, you know one thing you must have in mind, they're lying to you. They're trying to manipulate you by telling you a line of propaganda that's probably meant to cover up something that they're testing.
Well, I believe that's true, but honestly, John, I've had Dr. Avi Loeb of Harvard on the program, who wrote Extraterrestrial. He believes, and this is probably the biggest cover up of all, that a lot of these asteroids are actual ancient alien probes. And not only that. He makes me think when he's on the program that they know more about what's out there than they're leading on.
Oh, probably yes. Seriously, if you take your reality from the corporate media, if you have a television, if you are unfortunate enough to have a television in your house, I don't. I literally have not owned a television in my adult life, and that's why I have time to write and things. Take a piece of paper across the bottom of the screen and write the words "they're lying" on it, and just stick that on the screen, okay? And keep that in mind because they are, of course. Whatever they tell you, they're not telling you these things out of the goodness of their heart. They're telling you because they want you to believe something.
Yeah. But, John, I'm curious to know, when do you feel there is going to be the connection with the off-world, the neighboring planets that are populated that perhaps have been looking at us and observing us for hundreds or thousands of years? Is there any – because this is a big issue that I have. It's like, you know – Welcome to the Federation of Planets. As big a joke as that is from Star Trek, I think there's something. Yeah. I think there's something to it. You know what I mean? It's like
there may be, but I doubt. I really doubt there's going to be much in the way of spaceships landing on the White House lawn.
No,
if you look into the energy requirements to get from one star to another, it's really heartbreakingly difficult. So I think if anything is happening, there's probably a network of communication. We might be able to tap into radio signals going from star to star. And that would be absolutely fascinating. It might give us some serious head scratching because I think people underestimate just how aliens are likely to be. One of my other books, a novel of mine, Stars Reach, the aliens in that turn out to be these sort of blobby yellow things that live on gas. They drink gasoline and breathe methane, and they have almost nothing in common with us. And these are the aliens that we've gotten into contact with, and. they have a heck of a time figuring us out because they don't understand numbers. Numbers are not something in their culture, and the way they think of things in terms of flows makes no sense to us. And so there's all the it was fun to write. And it was my attempt to try to think, okay, what would a really alien species be like? And so there's the radio message going between us and Tau and the third planet of Tau Ceti, and they're trying to figure us out, and we're trying to figure them out.
That's funny. It's almost like you could make that into a movie.
I actually had a feeler on that novel from somebody connected to the studio. They didn't go ahead with it, but it would be fun.
Funny. The book's called The Twilight of Pluto, Astrology and the Rise and Fall of Planetary Influences. My guess is John Michael Greer. John, why should people get this book?
Why you should get this book is, first of all, if you have any interest in astrology, this gives you the context for, you know, how planetary influences change over time, and that's something worth knowing. If you want to get a sense of the sort of deeper patterns behind ordinary history, behind all the dramatic changes of our time that will continue to unfold between now and the time, or between 2006 and when the Pluto influence finishes winding down into around 2036, it's worth reading.
Excellent. John, a real pleasure. We're going to have you back on the program. Thanks for your time.
I will look forward to it.
Before I forget, I want to mention that John has a really in-depth website. It is located at https://www.ecosophia. I'm going to spell it out for you. ecosophia.net/. So Ecosophia is the website. He has his dream journal there. He does a regular dream journal. And he has an extensive bookshop, which covers a lot of his books. I found him on Amazon, but he's an independent writer, and he appreciates you buying books from his website. He's going to be back with us in the fall. He's written extensively on the question of ETs and unidentified aerial phenomenon, or his books came up before the change, which would be unidentified flying objects or UFOs, something that I have been and am continually fascinated by, and what is going on, why our government's not coming forth with it. And he told me just before we started that he has spent a great deal of energy learning why the American government, and specifically the United States military, refuses to come forth and give us details on these craft that they are spotting, that are visiting us, have probably been visiting us for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And interesting enough, the types of ships they fly. Now, that's something that's fascinating. Now, I want to give you a heads up for this upcoming Saturday's program. It's going to be with Dr. Heather Lynn. We've had Heather on a number of times. She is in the process of finishing a new book on ET archaeology, or as she calls it, exo-archaeology, a book that I applaud her for writing, a book that is desperately needed, that addresses what is going to happen when NASA JPL actually comes forth and says, yes, we have found the ruins of an ancient society, and this looks at what we, you know, this is what we're beginning to look at, blah, blah, blah. What are the implications for us? What are the societal changes that will take place? Now, I've always said that as soon as we discovered that we're not alone in our cosmos, that this will automatically change us. It will automatically evolve us as a race, because we will not be arrogant and think that we are the only ones here, which a lot of people believe, strangely enough, even in the face of scientists saying there are hundreds of millions of populated planets in nearby systems, and this is just the way it is mathematically or scientifically. Why it's so hard for them to believe that there's craft that are run or driven by highly advanced aliens is beyond me. You know, we've heard from Dr. A.V. Loeb, we've heard from NASA astronomer Marion Rudnick that this is going on constantly, constantly. So, you know, and it's funny because I'm just going to mention this. I was reading this the other day. I think that the military does know something. I think they know a hell of a lot, but I don't think they're able to, if there's an agreement with them in an alien race, I think it's very shaky because every time, and Marianne mentions this a few months ago, every time they spot a UFO, especially in Southern California, they will scramble F-18s or ships to go find them, go try to track them down, which is a complete joke. Why are they doing this? I mean, they should pull out an olive branch. I think it's just the backward nature of the military to be threatened by anything they don't understand, by technology they can't even conceive of, let alone try to capture or follow. It just freaks them out. It's just the nature of the military mind. It's backward, it's antiquated, and it just doesn't work. And these are the SOBs that are presenting Earth to these aliens. You know, if we stood there or if we sat down and broadcast, hey, hi, we want to meet with you. We would like to get to know you better, blah, blah, blah. No, instead, we're shooting at these guys. We're shooting at the aliens. God, what stupidity. You know, it's almost a cartoon the way we act. We're so... And this may be why we're not having more contact, because our military is trying to kill these guys. I don't know why I'm laughing. It's really, it's more of an anger. It's a nervous laugh. I'm angry about this. So anyhow, Dr. Heather Lynn on Saturday, this is going to be a phenomenal program. And I'm really looking forward to learning more about the protocols, about the criteria for meeting, for discovering, and how we go about learning about alien civilizations that are in our cosmos. That's Saturday. That will be July the 2nd on Earth Ancients. All right, I want to thank my guest today, John Michael Greer. It's a pleasure having him on the program. Again, we'll have him again, have him back in the fall. And as always, my team of experts that make Destiny happen. That is Ruth Thomas, Mark Foster, and everyone who edits and does the graphics. You guys rock! All right, take care, be well, and we will talk to you next time.